Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, time to talk with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. And we're going to talk about insects, especially the insects that enter our homes this time of year. Some even hitch a ride on your Christmas tree. I'd love to have you part of the conversation. Maybe you've seen some strange bugs on your indoor plants. Maybe you have some other bug questions for Phil. Maybe you have a picture of an insect that you'd like him to identify. You can do all that. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email with your question and or maybe your photograph to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
I tell you what, good to have you. Tell us about the types of insects that ride in on our Christmas trees.
Well, in the past there have been some misinformation. I remember years ago people were worried about bringing deer ticks in with their Christmas tree, and it just isn't where you expect them, and it would not. There's no reason to have any kind of problem with that. But the thing that I do see occasionally is some of the insects that are needle pests of some of the pines and firs and whatnot, when brought in the house, things warm up. And so I have seen some aphids. I have seen some gall midges. Little gnat-like critters is what most people would recognize them as. And, they don't hurt anything other than, I will say the aphids, if you crush them, they can leave a little bit of a stain. So you got to be a little bit careful. I mean, you could always vacuum them up. And usually they run their course within a day or two, and it's really not a big deal. And so it is unusual, but it happens on a regular enough basis. It's worth mentioning.
In 2018, I think it was, the Insect Diagnostic Lab wrote that the stink bug is a concern in Wisconsin as far as invasive insects. And we've talked about the stink bug before on the show, but maybe you could remind listeners why this insect is harmful.
Yeah, well, interesting. I talked to PJ, who's running the lab now, just about his perspectives on things. And, both he and I have observed that the stink bug numbers seem to be down somewhat yet this year. But it's got two claims for fame. The insect feeds on a wide variety of plants, causes damage on tomatoes and peppers and, things out in the vegetable garden. But really where probably it gets the most frustrating is it likes to sneak into people's houses. And this typically goes on in September and October. And then when you get the right conditions, a warm, sunny day on the south side of the house, the ones that are on the walls or attics wake up. And so you get this trickle of stink bugs all winter long. And, it gets frustrating. And the unfortunate thing is if you let them get in the walls or in the attic, you've kind of lost the war. If you're going to stop them, it's either a combination of sealing things up tight enough that they can't squeeze in. So you got to check vents and where siding meets walls, those kind of things. Or there are outside sprays that can be done when they do this migration in. But again, at this time of the year, I would suggest to folks just, vacuum them up or sweep them up, let them go outside, whatever you need to do. But at least in the southern part of the state, the numbers seem to be down compared. And, this can get very dramatic. When it first took off in the East Coast, back about 15 years ago now, I mean, you would see pictures of thousands of them on the side. And so, the nuisance value can be very high under the right conditions. We've seen not near that level, but we have seen those problems. But as I said, at least the encouraging thing is the numbers appear to be down this year.
Yeah. Ethan in Janesville has a question for you about a potential problem. Let's go there. Hi, Ethan.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having this program. I just wanted to know what Phil says about lantern flies and whether that is a threat coming down the pipeline in Pennsylvania right now.
Kind of, but at least the projections I have seen is climate-wise, they're not going to be quite as happy here as they are in some of the places they've taken off. As things continue to warm, one of my favorite lines on the show for years has been the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us. So I do expect at times they're going to show up, and that's just the question. As I said, we're just kind of on that fence of climate-wise of them being able to establish well or really have kind of a tough time here. So it's been an ongoing issue out east again for probably, you know, about 15 years.
Yeah, and what problems do they cause?
Well, you know, the plant damage is not overly concerning. You know, they're an aphid-like relative, but they can fly. But again, just a nuisance getting into things. And they have a wide host range. It seems to be a pattern of many of the invasives that cause us problems is rather than just picking on a particular plant, they will feed on quite a few. And they are transported probably most of the time on nursery stock and other things in their egg masses, and that seems to be the easiest way for them to move into an area.
Yeah. Ethan, thanks so much for that question. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number 1-800-642-1234. Or email us a question or your insect photo to ideas@WPR.org. What about the winter ant, Phil? What can you tell us about that insect?
Well, ants, our native ants pretty much go dormant and typically behave themselves and live outside. You know, the critical thing about any ants being active in the winter is they have to be in an environment that it's at least 50 to 55 degrees. And I'll tell you, as a rule of thumb, most of the ants that will pull this being active in the winter are not native ants. They are invasive ants. And if you see any ants when it's, below 50 degrees, yet they're running around in the house, that suggests they're nesting indoors. So, you know, we're talking from November all the way into March. Now, carpenter ants, which are native, will nest in wood materials. I generally don't see carpenter ants at least till January or February. And then again, I know they're in the interior of the house. So I think that's the big message is it's not normal to see ants in the winter. And if you do, it suggests they're nesting. And then the question is which ant species. Ants bait relatively well, but you've got to match the bait to what they want to eat. So try to pay attention if they seem to have a sugar need or they like protein, and then you can buy the appropriate baits. The nice thing about baits is they take it back and feed the other ants, and that's what kills the colony. Because the other way we approach ants is say, you must find the nest and treat it because that's where the queen is. But a lot of these ants that are nesting in wall voids and whatnot, it is not easy to find the nests. And again, some of these invasive ants, instead of having one nest, they're known to have multiple nests, which makes it even more difficult.
Mm. So you can put a spot of honey on the counter or wherever.
Yeah, and a little piece of wax paper and put a little cooking oil and put a little bit of something sweet like honey and see if they have a preference. There are some ants that feed on both. But what do you take that information and then pay attention to the various kinds of baits you can buy. And if you match the baits, the other advice there is you continue to provide them even after you think you've gotten them. It's worth keeping the baits out because sometimes people tend to back off early enough and they really don't take care of the colony. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, you're back into ants again. So.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest, joined in with your insect question. Love to hear from you. Well, are there some, I was going to ask you if there were some insects we shouldn't be squishing. You kind of mentioned that. Certainly the brown marmorated stink bug is one that I wouldn't want to be squishing.
Yeah, I know. Stink bugs, as their name implies, have a very distinctive, and I've yet to find somebody say it's a pleasant odor. It's not the end of the world, but, you can avoid it quite easily by just taking them outside and whatnot. And it would really be quite interesting. You know, what gets insects in trouble in the winter is when you warm them up and, physiologically they're active, and then you do a cold shock. Honestly, that kills them. Insects can survive 10 below if they can kind of prepare for it and get ready. But if you warm an insect up and then you throw, let's say something that infests a piece of wood and you want to disinfect it, warm it up, get the insects active, and then throw it in the freezer for a week. And honestly, that quick shock is what does them in.
Hannah from Beloit emailed. She said she saw a large increase in bees this year. Every restaurant she went to had a ton of bees outside. And she's wondering if there was an increase in bees and how should restaurants balance the collapse of bees and a decrease in business.
Yeah, if indeed it was in the late summer and fall and it was a place where food was, it probably were yellow jackets, which people often call bees, but they are... bees tend to be pollen in the nectar feeders, where yellow jackets are scavengers on protein and sugar. And I did notice a somewhat increase. Now, nothing like we saw 15, 20 years ago with German yellow jacket. And, you know, we had to cancel county fairs just about. They were so bad when there was food outside. But I did see kind of an increase compared to what it's been in the last few years. And, you know, at restaurants, it gets difficult because if there is a food source, these things learn it's there, and they almost get into the habit of coming back. And so you've got to keep things cleaned up as much as possible. You got to keep the trash cans well away from where people are going to eat. But the interesting thing is every year is a new slate. So just because we had a little bit of an increase this past year doesn't mean it's going to come back. So as I said, I usually, when I'm talking to people and they're explaining what they think is the problem, is try to get a handle on where and what these critters seem to be doing. And that is how I differentiate between the yellow jackets and wasps, which are the protein feeders, and the bees, which tend to really have no interest in people food.
Yeah. You know, it makes me think about pollinators, other pollinators, and how do we protect important pollinators during the winter? Is there anything that we can do?
Well, what is important, honestly, is diversity of habitat, because a lot of these things are spending the winter in inside plant stems and other things, and so, you know, we all like to go through the garden cleanup and the like, but be honest, removing some of that stuff is pulling where the overwintering sites of some of these pollinators would be. Even wood, you know, old dead wood that has bark beetle holes in it is often a site that some of the bees and whatnot use for nesting sites, and they overwinter as grubs in that wood, and then the critters come out in the spring when they mature into the adult critters. So, as I said, leaving some trash and debris, leaving a diverse area is worthwhile. And as I said, some of these even little bee houses and whatnot that are basically various size holes drilled into wood, or in some cases they use like bamboo of different sizes, are providing the kind of habitat that they can survive the winter and then be around for the next spring.
You know, I'm thinking about that. That might not be a bad holiday gift.
No, and I have seen maybe a little more of the Europeans than we do, but people have made bee hotels and whatnot that are really artistic gems, aside from being environmentally really neat. And so it's well worth looking on the internet and seeing some, give people some ideas. So, you know, they kind of look like birdhouses, but the difference is they're providing the right size holes and tubes for the various bees to make use of. And there are some wasp species that will use those too.
Yeah, and they're not all that, well, I'm sure you can get some pretty expensive ones, but typically they're not all that expensive.
No. And as I said, even some of them, you get a piece of wood and you get a drill and you're off and running. So,
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab back in 2014. Comes by every so often to talk with us about the world of insects, and I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSusa, our engineer today, Mackenzie Crummy, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri. You know, this seems like the perfect day to bring up the fact that we're wrapping up the first year of our book club. And the title of the book that we're reviewing is Bicycling with Butterflies, written by Sarah Dykeman. Phil, if you haven't read it, you ought to take a look at it. Sarah traveled over 10,000 miles following the monarch migration. She did it alone on a hand-built bike across three countries. And she's on December 23rd with a book. And you know what? There's still time to read it and join in the discussion when we talk with her on December 23rd at 11 o'clock. And again, the book is Bicycling with Butterflies, the author Sarah Dykeman. And it's a fascinating read. Phil, have you seen that book?
I have not, but I can, you know, I'm old enough to remember where we did not know where the monarchs were spending the winter. And, you know, people used to put little tags on the marks. It was kind of a school project. You'd let them go, and then somebody else would find it and use that to track the general direction. So it, you know, is real exciting. And I'm sure, aside from the fun of chasing the butterflies, there are lots of adventures involved with this.
Yeah, there are indeed. It's a really, really fun read. I'm enjoying it. I haven't finished it myself yet, but I will by the time December 23rd rolls around, for sure. Well, let's go back to our phones here. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Lynn in Allison Bay, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you having your guest on today.
Well, great to have you call in. What's on your mind?
Well, a couple of years ago, I was bitten by one of those nasty ticks and ended up with a horrible case of Lyme, which put me in the hospital in Green Bay for 3 weeks. And my question to your guest is, are we ever going to be able to get a vaccine for Lyme disease or better treatment? Or what can the average person do that they haven't been doing to keep the ticks off of them and keep them out of their yard? I do the tick tubes. I do the spraying with organic stuff. It seems to be a losing battle where I live.
Okay, so the question, would you define it as kind of a typical suburban yard, or are you more kind of out in the woods?
No, I would say it's in between. I have mm-hmm. very little grass, a lot of mulch, some large trees around me. But I'm so careful. I do have a dog, but she only goes out on a leash with me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do you find ticks in the yard on a regular basis?
No, mm-hmm. I don't, because I use the cedar side spray.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you where I picked up. Well, no, 2 years ago, I can tell you where I probably picked up the tick when I was in the woods on a hike.
Yeah.
I, you know, you describe your yard. It's not the typical place that they would thrive, you know, and it sounds like you've done quite a bit of homework as far as both some of the treatments and, you know, keeping things open, keeping things dry. I mean, the worst place I know to find deer ticks is when you're walking in the woods and you go through a raspberry thicket. I mean, they like the heavy, dense, somewhat humid areas where they seem to thrive. But again, there is work going on with the vaccine. And a friend of mine who had a similar bad time with Lyme disease has just passed on to me that he says it appears that they're getting pretty close to bringing another vaccine, which will be an improvement over the last one. So that's one of the options. Tick season, you know, basically runs anytime there's no snow on the ground. It's interesting today with the temperatures, you know, in the southern part of the state in the 60 degrees, you're out walking, I'd expect to pick up ticks if you're in an area that they would be found. So, you know, you got to keep your guard up. I spend a lot of time in the fall outdoors, and, you know, I have a lot of faith in the tick sprays for clothing. The type of sprays that will last, honestly, through a number of washings, because the whole idea is even though they are sold as a repellent, they have the kind of residual that if the tick walks on it, it will die well before it has the opportunity to transmit disease. Now, what gets a little difficult here is that even though the tick sprays are derived from a natural product originally, the sprays that are using now are synthetic versions. The problem with natural pyrethrum is it has no residual, and the chemists have modified it in a way that it holds up much better. So for people who are not comfortable with synthetic chemicals, now it's a little bit more of a dilemma, because said the pyrethrum you can buy, and yeah, it will last for a little time, but it breaks down in sunlight in the matter of minutes, and so it doesn't give the residual that you need. So where I would take my most care is when you go out for those hikes off property, because I really do think that that's where you run the biggest risk, and as I said, for in modifying your environment. And I've seen some pretty good stuff out of the East Coast, where, of course, in Connecticut and whatnot, they've dealt with Lyme quite a bit. Again, talking about some landscape adjustments. And, you know, it really what it is when you provide things that are open and barren and dry, the ticks don't like it. If you have areas where there is a lot of litter and debris, which keeps the moisture level up, that keeps the ticks happier.
Mm. Lynn, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Louie in Ocano has, I think, a word about ticks as well. Hi, Louie.
I guess that's the question of today, ticks. My question, I guess you kind of were getting into it, where anytime above freezing, pretty much you can run into ticks. Is there like a bumper season where,
Most of us grew up with what we call the wood tick, which is the American dog tick, and that is much more seasonal. That's a spring and early summer thing, and then it kind of stopped. When the deer tick started to establish in the state back in the 70s and 80s, we are caught by a little bit of surprise because, again, it's got life stages that are active throughout the year. Although if you had to talk, well, I don't even know if you can argue the peak time. The adults are active in the spring and then again about mid-October until however long it can go. The immature stages are active in the middle of the summer. And even though the immature stages don't carry as much disease as the adults, the evidence suggests that more people become sick from bites from immature ticks. And I think one of the main reasons, they're small enough, they're easily overlooked if they've been feeding on you, whereas adult tick is bigger, big enough that most people have the opportunity to pull it off within the 24 to 36 hours that it first gets on you. And then you really don't have to worry because it does take time to transmit Lyme disease. Now, there are some other tick-borne diseases that go quicker. And again, that's the interesting thing as we continue every 4 or 5 years, it seems, another new disease. You know, we've got ehrlichiosis, we've got anaplasmosis. So it's not just Lyme disease we worry about ticks. And this darn deer tick, or what really is technically called the black-legged tick, is the main culprit for all the tick transmission we see in Wisconsin. Not elsewhere, but in Wisconsin.
Louis, thank you so much. Appreciate it. And you know what? Let's go to Rick in South Range, who also has a question relating to ticks. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. Back in the 90s, I was a high school science teacher, and I got involved in a test study, I think, for a vaccine for Lyme disease called Lymerix. And that was taken off the market because of the arthritic side effects of it. Is there any efficacy to that medication? I was so excited about it. I had my two young daughters vaccinated and my wife. And I'm just curious to know if that's ever coming back.
Yeah, well, as I said, from what I hear, there is another vaccine. You know, one of the problems with that vaccine, it took two doses and the like. And it really, market-wise, wasn't selling that well aside from, you know, the human health concerns. But as I said, there seems to be evidence, I think, with new technology and especially with, you know, how prevalent Lyme disease has become in the Midwest and in the Northeast. Because every year you see the figures and it continues to climb upward and upward. And so I think all that justification, as I said, from at least chatting with a friend of mine, he was really quite encouraged about the direction where the vaccines are going.
Rick, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We've been on ticks for a few calls, but we can take all kinds of other questions relating to insects as well. 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Another Rick, this one in Belleville. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Larry. Hi, Phil. So I didn't call about this, but I used to be an ER doc, and we're treating deer tick exposures, you know, pretty aggressively, or we worked while I was still working, with a single dose of doxycycline, depending on the rules. And the public can look up on the CD site what those rules are before they go to their doctor, but we are being very aggressive about prophylacting. Once a deer tick is removed, it has something to do with how long it's been on, whether it's engorged or not. But anyway, we're really trying to get on top of this. But the reason I called, we were cutting and splitting wood up in Minocqua this past week. And some of that wood was packed with carpenter ants. And they seemed to be dead. It had been 11 below zero up there, but we knocked all of them out as we could. But my question is, are those ants dead, or is it a possibility that they're dormant because we were taking some of this wood inside to dry it out so we could use a wood burner? So that's my question.
Yeah, I would wonder if they're just dormant, you know, because if it's below 50 degrees, they're not going to be active. And, you know, it depends a bit on the microenvironment. You know, the ants that are in the hollow trees are going to survive 11 below just fine and be active against next spring. And so I do get this concern. And it's interesting because up north, I think we have a lot of people that have a lot more wood burners, and it's such an important heat source. I used to get in a little bit of a conundrum because I would tell people to store the wood outside and bring enough in for a couple, 3 days. Well, of course, some people would like the whole basement to be full. And the problem with that is you wake up these dormant ants. And, you know, it is not a structural problem, but it's a nuisance problem. My first take on it is if there appeared to be a healthy colony this summer, they were probably just dormant. Now, exposing them like that increases mortality quite quickly. I'm always judging it on temperature. If it's below 50 degrees, I don't expect them to be able to move just because they're cold-blooded critters. But once they warm up, even though they have been exposed to some amazingly cold temperatures, it's amazing how quickly they kind of defrost and start active. In a comment on your treatment, you know, what changed is the percentage of ticks that carry the disease. And once it gets above 20% in the adult ticks, the CDC does recommend if you knew it was a deer tick and you suspect it was on you for a period of time to get that one day's dose. And honestly, I have an email ready for my physician every time I get a tick exposure, and he's well aware of it. And so that's the way to go, because the difference is if you treat it early, it seems to be quite treatable. The unfortunate thing is, much like the earlier caller, we have people that had no idea they had the exposure, and then they get into a number of days, if not a number of weeks, of the disease being active in their system, and then it's a much more difficult thing to treat.
Yeah. So, Rick, next time you're back up to Minocqua, you might find a few ants roaming around. God, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Diane in Stoddard, we'll go to you now. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi. We didn't really collect chrysalises from the monarch butterflies because all of the butterflies we had didn't come into our yard this year. So the year before, what happened, we collected them and we mounted them and we were watching them emerge, and many of them were deformed. Then we started watching the caterpillar stage, and we found that there was a little tiny bee that put in an egg or something. And then that basically was the problem of the development through the chrysalis, and you could see that they were emerging. We didn't have one successful monarch that year, mm-hmm. and I collected hundreds of chrysalises.
Yeah, there is a whole litany of natural parasites, and this is common throughout all kinds of caterpillars, and unfortunately the monarch gets the same thing. These are parasitic wasps. And depending on the species, they either sting the caterpillar or sting the pupal stage, and the grubs develop internally, and they allow the monarch caterpillar to make the chrysalis, but then they basically consume them inside. And often what you might witness or might have seen is a little tiny hole cut out of the chrysalis, and all of a sudden you get these little wasps emerging instead of the butterfly. And, you know, this is typical in the insect world of the females laying hundreds of eggs, and only a couple surviving, because between the diseases and the parasites and the predators, there's very high mortality. And we have better success if you're lucky enough to catch the monarch caterpillars when they're small, bring them into the house or another protected environment, and basically babysit them. We get much less parasitization because they're not out exposed to what happens in nature. But it is an unfortunate, but the way the world works type of thing. And as I said, the norm is not to be successful in getting to the adult stage. And so when you have that happen, it really is a special treat.
Yeah. Diane, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Pete from Maquantico emailed and asked if there is a native honeybee or are they all European? And do honeybees maintain their nests through the winter or do they restart the hive annually? Pete fed honeybees in his yard with sugar water.
Okay, so honeybees are not native to North America. They are basically more of an African or Middle Eastern species, and there are different strains out there now, but of course they've been here. It's interesting, the Native American populations used to talk about them being white man flies, was one of the comments that they would make about them. But the other side of it is they are the one species that overwinters as a colony and lives for years, if you think of it that way, which is not the norm. All our wasp and bees typically do not. They start everything from scratch, whether it's the adults come out or that's the more typical. They're in pupal cases, and then the adults come out and start things. So what the honeybee has to do is generate enough heat that they don't freeze to death, and that's why the amount of honey that is inside the colony is very important, because if they run out of this fuel, they can't generate the heat by buzzing their little wings, and then the colony freezes. And so you do see that relationship on the severity of our winter affects our survival rate, and it is quite typical, even before all these diseases and everything else, for us to lose 30 to 40 or even 70% of our bees, just because this is a pretty hostile climate. In fact, again, it's really quite amazing to me that they have as high a survival they do in some cases. And that's where beekeepers have the advantages. They can manipulate the hive in a way to keep it strong and to have enough honey, not to take it all away, and to give the honeybees a better chance of survival than they would have normally. And now, the other side of it is if honeybees were not here, we have almost 400 species of native bees. So we do have pollinators that are out there. But many of our agriculture and vegetable crops have been bred purposely to be more attractive to honeybees, so they pollinate them. And so there's this interesting dance going on. But sometimes when I see comments, yes, it would be terrible if the honeybees were gone. But to me, the bigger picture is the number of native species and doing what we can do to promote those, because honestly, they were taking care of business before honeybees came to this continent.
Yeah, good points. Jeff called, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to know if the Luna moth is dangerous or not.
Oh, no, those are just an absolute treat, especially if you like bugs. I don't get to see many Luna moths around Madison. They have this very interesting kind of a whitish-green coloration to the adult moths. And the thing that's distinctive, they have these long tail-like structures off of the hind wings. Now, they feed on walnut and other common trees out there, but you will find that in some areas they're not quite common. I'd probably see them more commonly northward in the state. The adults only live for 2 or 3 days at best. The adults do not feed. The adults make great bat food, and that's their biggest problem is at night when they're out flying is honestly the bats and other predators tend to feed on them. So if you're lucky enough to see one, enjoy it, but there's nothing about them. Again, the adults are totally harmless, can't feed or bite. They don't have functional mouth parts, and the caterpillars just feed on the leaves of trees, so that's no big deal.
Laura in northern Iowa County emailed and asked, why do cluster flies develop on our windows in the cold seasons? How do we manage and prevent them?
Okay, so the story with cluster flies, they look similar to house flies. Under the microscope, what we pick up is that they have this very fine golden hairs on their thorax, the middle of their body. It reminds me of corn silk, to be honest. And they are parasites of earthworms during the summer. So they lay their eggs. Their maggots kill the earthworms. But their claim to fame is this fall invasion. So people will call them winter flies or, you know, similar things. Or cluster fly refers to this fact that they are looking for protected places. And that often means up into your eaves and attic spaces and the like. And then like these other fall invading critters, when conditions get mixed up, They warm up, they become active, and so they will filter down into the living space through light fixtures and other openings in your wall. And it gets very frustrating because what happens, you see them at the windows or even between the windows, especially if the problem is in the adjacent wall. And you can kill them, spray them, vacuum up, whatever, and then tomorrow they seem to be right back there. And it's not that they're breeding. You're just getting reaping the problem of what snuck in last fall. And honestly, the critical time for those critters seems to be September, maybe early October. You win or lose the war by then. The only thing you see fluctuate is very dry years when the worms aren't doing so well, then the cluster flies don't do so well. The other intriguing thing is where your house is located. Having a beautiful southern exposure overlooking a valley may be great for the aesthetic side of it, but honestly, for cluster flies, you could be drawing those things from who knows how far away. You take that same house and you put it in the woods where the sun doesn't get to the south side of the house, and there's far less problems. It's kind of an exposure thing that the flies react to that sunny side of the house in the fall, and that's what draws them into the structure.
Phil, a listener emailed to ask, what is the best pesticide to spray doors and windows to prevent the box elder bug and the Asian beetles that, and they want something that's safe for humans and canines?
Okay, so where we are with insecticides that are sold to homeowners is a majority of them come from the same family. They're the same things. And again, it's the same product that I was mentioning used for tick sprays. These are synthetic versions of pyrethrin. And so it's permethrin and cypermethrin and the like. And what you find when you go to the local hardware store is about 95% of the stuff on the shelves is for that. Now, they formulate this stuff different depending on the use. So the stuff that's made for putting on your clothes, even though it's the same chemical, it's the other additives that are different because what you need to have happen when you spray on the side of the house is you need to extend the residual, and you don't have to worry so much about safety factors because once the spray dries, it doesn't go anywhere. So you get the home defense or, you know, the other types of products, as I said, they're all going to be very similar, and you spray around these potential openings, but timing is everything. And so, as I said, same with box elder bugs. That's a fall invading critter. You got to remind yourself, and at this time of the year, we tell people don't bother. I mean, it just, they've already gotten into the structures. The other side of it is if you can figure out, when I'd get a call from somebody and say, you know, I only see Asian lady beetles in my upstairs bathroom. What's wrong? The first thing that would come to mind for me is if they have a vent fan, is it screened properly? Because if it's not, they've got probably a hole in their soffit. And when the critters come, they work through the vent fan, and that's how they get in. So sometimes the pattern gives it away. On the other hand, if you see the critters throughout the house, it gets much more difficult. And as I said, then you consider either spraying yourself or, you know, for big, tall, three-story buildings, it'd be hard for somebody to spray. There are commercial sprays that can be done. But make sure it's done in the fall. Again, somebody spraying in the spring, I don't care because the critters are leaving. They're not coming back in. And so I really don't see a justification for trying to stop these things in the spring because whatever you do now will not influence the population in the following fall.
Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. You can join in, too. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email. Maybe with a question, or if you've got a photo of an insect you want to have identified, or maybe you just got a pretty photo of one, you can do that too at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. I wanted a reminder, give you a reminder that Santa will be stopping by for his annual visit with us on Christmas Eve. And this year, if the kids aren't able to phone on since it's Christmas Eve, Santa, we can do it. We can do the next best thing. They can leave him a message on our voicemail. And the voicemail number is 833-424-3227. All right, I'm sorry. Let me do it again. 833-424-3327. Or could me email to ideas@WPR.org and put Santa in the subject line and just the child include their first name, age, and city. Santa would love to hear about any good deeds that they have done this year, why Santa should stop by their home, or any other questions they might have. And get those messages to us by December 22nd, and we'll try to read or play them on the air. That's for those who can't call in on Christmas Eve. And if you didn't get the number, we'll put that. Go to ideas@WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's date, and in the program notes, we'll have the phone number and the email and all the other information for you for Santa. Well, let's get back to the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, and Bob in Kewaunee has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question is about the spotted Asian beetle that used to be a plague in the Kewaunee area. And this year they are obvious by their absence. There's hardly any. I'm just wondering if there was something that happened or sprays or something that was something done, or did they just die?
Well, you know, every year can differ, but the general trend is when this thing first hit the fan, and that was in the mid-90s in Wisconsin, I got so many calls on a Halloween day that my phone went dead because I could never put it down enough to recharge it. And it was funny to me because at that time, they used to call this the Halloween beetle, and it had more to do with the color, I think, than anything else. Since then, even though, you know, I think we've all experienced almost science fiction-like populations at times, it has dropped dramatically. And, you know, if I ever finish my book, I've got a chapter on invasive insects. And in one of the interesting observations that many people have made, and I made, is that when things get here that don't belong, they're often the most problematic the first few years, and then things will balance out. And I think that's where we are at, is that, you know, we were very concerned about the Asian lady beetle displacing a number of our native species, and they did push them pretty hard. But things are now coming to the point. They've got parasites, they've got diseases and other things, and so this Harmonias, it was the scientific name we give this critter, I have noticed the same thing. It you know, it's out there a little bit, but it's, I don't think, a tenth, maybe even a 20th of what the populations were back in the heydays in the late 90s and early 2000s throughout the state.
Bob, thank you so much for calling. John in Chippewa Falls. Hi, John. What's on your mind? Whoop, I guess we lost John. Let's see. John actually found a large mosquito at the dog park and was wondering what the heck's going on.
Well, you know, we have over 50 species of mosquitoes, and most of them overwinter as eggs, but we do have some species that overwinter as adults. So again, you can get the right conditions, and, you know, I remember in the lab having people send me mosquitoes in January on a nice sunny day. And so it would probably be one of those adult overwintering species. There is one particular species, in fact, they sometimes refer to as a gall nipper because it's about three times bigger than the average mosquito. Off the top, I can't remember if that species overwinters as an adult or not, but that would be my first take, is that even though we're late, you think we're past the mosquito season. The environment that most of these things will, the adults will spend the winter in, is caves, tree holes, and sometimes in people's basement, because if you think about it, you know, a damp basement's like a cave. So the same thing, I occasionally would get somebody who would get a mosquito bite in the house, and then you got to talk, and yeah, somebody, you know, the kids sleep downstairs in the basement, and those mosquitoes were probably sitting on the wall, just kind of half dormant, but you get the right conditions, and they warm up, and they can become active.
There we go. John, did you, I think we got John. John, are you there? Oh, we lost you. Okay. Well, I think you did a good job answering that question, Phil. Let's go to Mark in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Say, this past year, I tried putting in some raised beds outside, and I put in some basil plants. I harvested part of the leaves off of them, and I went back the next day, and they were just covered with Japanese beetles. and I've got kind of two questions. Is there any way to control them? And in the back, a farmer had planted corn plants this year. Are they drawn to corn?
Not so much. They like a lot of things, and basil, honestly, I think is in their top 10 list of what they want to eat. And the common thing with Japanese beetles is once they show up, they kind of gang up on plants. It's really quite interesting. Because they're flying in from down the road, there really is nothing you can do in your property that's going to make a difference. I think the thing to consider, what we do in our backyard is when they start to come on, honestly, we have a little net-like device that we put over the plants so they get enough sunlight, but there's a physical barrier that they can't get to. And that probably is the best. You know, there are some organic sprays that can be used, but you got to wait. You know, it's just more problematic. And so, as I said, if they don't show, no problem. But if they do start to show up, I think physically trying to protect the plants, with Remay or other kinds of netting that are sold, or you can construct something yourself. Where it gets more difficult, people that have big raspberry patches and whatnot, when I say that, they just roll their eyes, and I understand. But for smaller things, as I said, I think that's an option. And the other thing I hope goes your way is, you know, much like we talked about the Asian lady beetle, the Japanese beetle populations in my neighborhood aren't even a 40th of what they were back in 2000. And so, you know, I had to look hard to find them. And it blew me away because I live about two blocks from a golf course, so there's no reason why we shouldn't be overrun with them. But again, what you tend to find is that when they get in an area, they're most problematic the first few years, and then they start to balance out down the road.
Thanks again for that question. Larry called, couldn't stay with us, wants to know how to deal with gypsy moths. Larry has old oak trees, and the gypsy moth stripped the leaves. How does he control them next year?
Okay, so two things to look at here. The dry spring did not do us any favors. What we have found is if we get normal moisture levels in the spring, it promotes a fungus disease that is devastating to the caterpillars. And what it takes to get into gypsy moth headaches is dry springs, which allow a much better survival. The gypsy moth right now is at an egg mass. These things will look about the size of a 50-cent piece. They're whitish, and they literally contain hundreds of eggs. And one of the things that has been done is they've used things like soybean oil and other sprays on the egg masses to kill them. Now, this probably is going to be best done today, honestly, would be a workable day because it's warm enough. But you don't want to spray when it's 10 below zero out, so you wait until March. Or you can scrape them off. You can go there. But the idea is every egg mass you take out, you're taking 150 to 200 caterpillars out. So that will make a bit of a difference. Mm-hmm. But in the longer run, as I said, I'm hoping for a little bit of a weather help. Gypsy moth, although it has been problematic in the state, it is nothing like the populations they were seeing out east, back in the 60s and 70s. And one of the main reasons is this fungus disease has shown up. And as I said, it really does make a difference. But this dry weather that patterns we're getting into is not good for us.
Yeah. I was thinking about my own neighborhood. As I was walking through the neighborhood, I saw some egg masses on a pretty young oak tree that, one of these curb trees that had been planted. And I just scraped them off. I think I got rid of a few, gypsy moths in our neighborhood.
And the other thing is don't overreact. I was at one of my high school reunion this year, and a woman came up to me, and we were talking, and she had a gypsy moth problem in Madison, and somebody had it was going to come and potentially spray her trees, but they were talking over $1,000 worth of a bill, and I think the way to go in most cases. They were, I think, going to wait until the spring and try to spray these big trees after the caterpillars hatch out. And again, you're balancing what's going to happen naturally. And as I said, if anybody were to say, maybe we can treat the trunks and whatnot and kill the egg masses, I don't think it would be near as expensive. And honestly, I think it would be much more effective.
And you can go online and take a look and see what those egg masses look like. I know I've done that. Is there a site? Or I think maybe if you just Googled it, you'd probably...
Yeah, you just do gypsy moth. USDA's got great stuff, Wisconsin Department of Ag, DNR. There's just lots of good websites that will give you some background and the like. And it is interesting because in at least the Madison area, there hasn't been much activity But there's definitely this uptake. And as I said, I write it off to the way the spring weather came about.
We have, let's see, I had another one email that I, Bob emailed. He, to prevent bugs from entering his house through holes in doors or windows, he applies a small piece of all-weather sticky tape to cover the visible holes. And he says that prevents bugs from entering.
Yes. Oh, no, definitely. The physical, you know, the argument about physically solving the riddle is it is a long-term solution. That's the frustration of the sprays, is that, you know, whatever you do this year, you got to do it again next year. Now, some houses are a little bit too leaky, but if you've got any idea, indeed, that's really the best way to go. It's well worth your time.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, and he will be with us right up till 12:30 today taking your insect questions. And I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Phil. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, the former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He comes on pretty regularly to talk about insects, and we'll take any insect questions or comments that you might have. So give a call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to the phones. Kay in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kay.
Yes, hi. I have found a couple little, about a third of an inch. They're not really a bug, and they're not really a caterpillar. They're almost like a little worm. They're kind of blackish gray, and if I try to touch them, they wiggle away. And they're kind of shiny. And I'm wondering if that description fits anything. And I found them in my kitchen.
Okay. So what I'm suspicious of, although typically the critters are a little bit lighter colored, is the immature stage of both beetles and some moth species that attack various dry goods, you know, various foods that you'd have in your cupboard. Things like cereal and spices and nut meats and the like, even dried fruit. Some of them are hairy, some are not. It depends on the species. If you had a picture, you could always send it into the radio station, or also to PJ, who runs the Insect Diagnostic Lab. But what I would suggest is kind of go through things, and you might have to look in cupboards that you do not think you got food in, but there could be something that's, you know, a box of something you forgot about. You know, it's one of these problems that if you find the source and dispose of it, you solve it. If you don't find the source, you don't, is the thing. And so it's worth it. You know, it's not dangerous. They don't bite. It's not harmful to eat them. But what you worry about is, given time, they're pretty good at getting into other packaging. So I think it'd be worth looking at all your dry goods and just see if you can find anything. Sometimes you see webbing. Sometimes you see holes in the package. Sometimes you see what almost looks like dust or sawdust that's coming out, which is often the digested food that they've pushed out. So, as I said, that would be the first place I would look. If that doesn't appear to be, then, as I said, if you can somehow get a specimen or a picture over to PJ, then I think he can give you a more definitive answer.
Yeah, there you go, Kay. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Mary Kay in Fox Point. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. My question is, we had a fly hatch in our basement with, I would say, a couple hundred flies. And I was just wondering what the source of that could be. We do have two sump pumps down there. Mm-hmm. We don't It's a finished basement. You know, we just woke up one day and went in the basement and
flies everywhere, huh?
Flies everywhere, which is like a Alfred Hitchcock movie, actually. But
sure.
Yeah.
So with that history, my take is they are one type of blowfly or flesh fly, and something died, and probably in the wall or the attic. Within 10 days to 2 weeks, you get this explosion of flies. Once the food source is exhausted, they're done. Some of those flies, if you look carefully, are almost metallic. We call them bottle flies because of that, you know, blue bottle and green bottle. Some of them are not, some of them are hairy. But as I said, that's the exact scenario I expect if something dies. And, you know, if it caught your attention, it was a squirrel or something, and you started to smell something foul, that's fine. But sometimes you don't. It could be in a part of the house that you're not getting that air circulation. But what happens when the flies often breed on the source, the maggots migrate away from the food, and then they transform into the adult flies, so you see them popping out from somewhere else. So the good news is, if it was reoccurring, if it was something big like a raccoon, I'm sure I could breed thousands of flies from a carcass that big. So it doesn't sound anything that big. But 200 flies, that's getting into the squirrel size or bird size possibly. And as I said, sometimes it's easy to solve this, sometimes it's not, but usually it runs its course by itself.
There you go, Mary Kay. Thank you so much for calling. Tom in Pewaukee, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Excuse me. I've got a number of hibiscus plants that I bring in the winter, and I've had them for about 5 years. But last year and this year, I've had a problem with some small white flying bugs that I just can't seem to get rid of. I've tried some 7 spray and some insecticidal soap, and they just don't disappear.
So the little white flies get on the leaves?
Yes.
Okay. It's a critter we call white flies. And honestly, unfortunately, you inherit. I mean, white flies are not native outdoors in Wisconsin, but they're a greenhouse pest. And they do come on greenhouse transplants and then breed, and they get on tomatoes and all kinds of other things. And hibiscus is a plant that they would like to get, so you somehow are inheriting it. And then a wrestling match is the best way to describe the treatment, because it isn't so much what you use, is you have to use it on a pretty strict basis. And there are life stages of white flies that can't be killed very easily. So what we suggest, the insecticidal soap would be a choice, but you have to go on a 5-day spray schedule. You spray again in 5 days, you spray again in 5 days, and maybe even a fourth treatment, at least a third. And if you miss a treatment, it's kind of like starting at scratch, because you don't affect the eggs, you don't affect their transformational stage very well with the sprays, and you need good coverage, because soap is only a contact kill. There's no residual to it. So it is a bit of a wrestling match. And as I said, unfortunately, normally you don't expect a problem, because, you started with clean plants and put them out there. But as I said, you inherited some white flies from a neighbor's peppers or tomatoes or some other source that they eventually got from the greenhouse anyway. And it's kind of interesting. White flies generally don't do all that well outside in our climate, but they don't need to. But once you bring them indoors, of course, it's a perfect environment. There's no predators or other things, and that's when they tend to explode.
Thank you, Tom. Good luck. Appreciate it. Another Tom, this one in Peshtigo. Hi, Tom.
Hi. In September, I saw a couple praying mantises, which is very unusual. I don't think I've ever seen them up here. I'm just wondering, are they native around here? Are they going to be here next year? Do they mate around here?
Sure. So there are two species of mantids you could find in the state. One is from China, one is from Europe, so neither are native. And this is one of those things that suggests that our winters continue to get warmer, because mantids overwinter as an egg case, which looks kind of about the size of a golf ball, but it's a real spongy and light. And usually they freeze out. I mean, that was typical. When I was a kid, we never had mantids breeding in the state. And now we know we have them breeding at least in the southern third and up in Door County, where the climate is a little bit more temperate in the winter. And will that continue to extend its range? Yes. The big caveat is how cold in the winter, because these egg masses are sitting out on twigs and whatnot, so they're really quite exposed. you know, and if we limp through a winter and don't see any really significant cold, that would speak to survival and go on. And I remember even one time watching a baseball game in Milwaukee, and a manta came flying out of the sky and landed on the guy next to me, which was really put him in quite a bit of shock. As I said, and we do see them in Madison now, and it's been pretty much the last 10 years or so. And as I said, I equate that to the lack of old-fashioned Wisconsin winters that an old guy like me put up with back in the 60s and so. But.
There you go, Tom. Thank you so much. Well, you can join in too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Dennis in Two Rivers, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I have a couple of things. I just was thinking about the praying mantis. When they fly, they look pretty weird. But a couple of things is, Larry, when you scrape gypsy moth egg mass off of a tree, what do you put it in? Do you flush it down a toilet, or do you just drop it on the ground and squash it?
Yeah, the latter.
Okay. And as far as insects finding food sources, I just wonder about rodents stashing food somewhere, and maybe people don't find it, but insects can find it.
Yeah, one of the worst cases I ever saw in my career, there was a person that was feeding somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 pounds of bird seed a year in there. They lived out in the woods in the cabin. And all of a sudden, they got into one of these stored product problems, you know, where it was a moth species that gets into bird seed. And it was just overwhelming them. And when they opened the walls up, there was bird seed stashed literally 3 and 4 feet high in the wall voids. And so I have run across variations of that, not quite that dramatic in most cases, of just what you say is if you've got nut meats or other food. Pet food is another thing that sometimes mice will steal and put into the walls. And then, you know, down the road we get into this insect problem that's associated with dry goods, but they can't find the source. You know, it gets, you know, it's not worth ripping the walls apart, but it gets quite frustrating, as you can imagine.
Dennis, thank you for calling. Scott in Appleton, hi.
Hello there. I have these stink bugs that are infesting my apartment. I open up suitcases, and there they are. I turn on the lights at night, and they're on the ceiling. I vacuum, suck them up with the vacuum real fast. When you touch them, they stink. They make your fingers smell bad. Yep. What are they? And
sure.
Just tell me about them.
Okay, so this is that brown marmorated stink bug, or some people call it Asian stink bug, and it came into the United States back in the 90s in the Pennsylvania area and then moved into our state. We were just starting to see trickling in the later about 2007, 2008, and they continue to spread. I think, PJ, the records are now in about 40 counties. They're probably in more, you know, but their claim to fame is this kind of assault that you're seeing. But unfortunately, is everything that was going to transpire happened in September and October. So they're either in your attic space of the apartment or the wall voids, and then you get the right conditions, like today, that's going to be quite warm. I expect them to be quite active. You get into January where you've got a 10 below, and I know the walls or attic is too cold, you don't see any. But it will kind of keep going. But the frustration for you is you can't get to the source anymore. You know, it's not like they're all piled up in a corner of the bedroom, because you'd see it and you could take care of it. They're into kind of some void space. And as I said, and then they're working down through light fixtures or electrical outlets or other openings, or even sometimes the seam between the window frame and in a wall incoming. So look around. You know, it may be sometimes, I know people have put tape around the seams around their ceiling fans and other things, just trying to see if they can physically head them off at the pass before they can work into your living space. Again, it may be worth talking to the people that manage the apartment for next year, either looking at what they can seal things up or indeed, again, spray on the outside of the structure in fall But at this time of the year, other than cleaning up what invades your living space, there's just really not anything that's going to make any difference.
Good luck, Scott. Thank you so much. Kurt emailed, wants to know if wood ticks have larval and juvenile stages like the deer ticks do, and if so, he's hoping you can recommend a place where he can see photos.
So the life stage of a tick, they hatch from an egg into an immature stage that we define as a larva. It only has 6 legs, so it would remind you of an insect. The next stage is the nymphal stage. It's the intermediate stage. It has 4 pairs of legs, like a tick's supposed to, and then they finally transform into the adult, which is the reproducing stage. Identifying ticks gets a little tricky because it has to do with color patterns on the little shield on their back and little seams. But if you do a search, in one of the places that I go quite a bit for pictures is a place called Bug Guide. Now, Bug Guide has literally millions of photographs. And so if you don't know what you're looking for, it can be very frustrating. But if you go to Bug Guide and look under wood ticks or American dog tick, you will get all kinds of pictures and of all kinds of life stages. You know, they give you the option to pick adults versus immatures in some cases, and that would be one place. Or again, I think if you just did a search on Dermacentor is the genus of the wood ticks or American dog ticks, or that there's a West Coast species, and you could get stuff there. But as I said, I think I'd try Bug Guide because I know that they have a big enough database that you could probably pick it up. And they're not quite as, of course, quite a bit smaller. And the colors, they tend to be not quite as pronounced. And many of these things like wood ticks have markings on that little shield. We call it a scutum. I call them painted ticks because it reminds you of somebody just taking a paintbrush along the back. You do not see those kind of markings in the immature ticks, and that's why they're harder to identify.
Bob in Eau Claire, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind today?
Well, just a comment about a whole colony of orb spiders that I nurtured all spring and summer long till the fall. We have these big eaves and soffits over our entryway, and there was a colony of about, 10, 13 of them. Big ones, they must have been 1.5 inches with the leg span, and there was, they had little groupings that they're about 3 feet apart, and there was a great big huge boss one, and then there would be another one smaller and then a little one. And my job, because I nurtured them, was to scrub the spider poop up.
Oh, dear.
They pooped up quite a batch every week.
So one of the questions, if they liked that so much, you must have some night lights that are on all night that are attracting insects in, which makes great spider food. Because when you get, I usually would get complaints about spider problems around lakes, because, of course, there's lots of things that come out of the water. But it's because of the great big lights on the piers or on the cabins. And if they're on all night, as I said, it's just like a magnet to bring insects in, and spiders take big advantage. So do you have something like that that would account for so much spider food to keep the spiders so happy?
We have a 120-acre farm here, and we have an antique shop, and it has the old farm light on it, 600 watts,
yep.
Always on.
Yeah.
So one thing you might consider, I mean, it sounds like you like spiders, so you might want not to go that way, but you might look to see if there's a different kind of bulb that can be used that is, has a light frequency that would attract less insects. You know, one of the things that goes on, like in food plants, they have to worry, and of course they need security lighting. And if you put the light above the door, you're drawing all these insects into the building, which is not good. You take the light, you put it on a pole and shine it on the door, the insects go to the pole and attack the light that way. And so sometimes there are physical adjustments you can do to kind of improve the situation. But as I said, if it's problematic, because I don't think spider poop is very easy to get off. I mean, it's protein-based, and it's almost like a varnish or a paint. And so I don't envy you having to try to scrub that stuff off.
Yeah, Bob, great story. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Becky emailed, and she sent a photo of this as well. It's a red banded leaf hopper. She's noticed them near the ferns in her house, or did, in late summer. Colorful and cute, and indeed they are. And she's trying to figure out where its mouth is.
Okay, I didn't get that picture, but the way leaf hoppers go, they've got a little bit of a flat face, and it slants down towards their abdomen. And at the very tip of that, they are a sucking insect. So they have a very tiny little straw-like device. Honestly, they can retract a little bit. So it isn't near as obvious as you might think. But if you turn the critter over on its belly and you had a magnification, you should be able to see the mouth parts there at the very tip of the face. And as I said, usually they're kind of pointing down towards the abdomen and towards the back of the critter.
And we had another photo of someone wondering if they had a ladybug or what it was. It's kind
of okay. Yeah, that one I did get. And so that is one of the varieties of the multicolored Asian lady beetle. And, you know, the norm of it comes with 19 dots on the back, but you will find some that have very few dots. And honestly, there is a black strain with two red dots, and it's the same species. So they are that variable. And that's why the official scientific term multicolored Asian lady beetle refers to that diversity of color forms. So if you see them clustered in the fall on the side of the house, just take a look. And again, I think you'll see some of the diversity. Some are real deep orange. Some are almost yellow in base color. And then the variety of dots. And as I said, every once in a while, you get a black one with two red dots.
Greg in Waukesha, what's on your mind?
We have the occasional stink bug, but not very often, and so we never kill them. We just pick them up and throw them out, unless it's really cold. Then we just leave them alone. But my question is, what is their function in nature? I assume birds aren't, you know, they don't really make great bird food because of their stink. But what do they do for us?
Well, not such good things. Only it's a type of insect. There are some beneficial kinds of stink bugs, but this particular one is a plant feeder. And when it feeds on something like a tomato, it causes a really bizarre spot. Some people call them ghost spots. If they feed on very small fruit, they honestly prevent it from developing. They feed on raspberries. They make the raspberry they fed on to be, taste pretty awful. So as I said, in general, from a human perspective, you can't say many nice things about them. They are one of the multitude of plant-feeding insects. And again, what's typical of these invasives, they feed on such a wide variety of things. And if they only pick on one plant, it's not near as much of an impact as something that, as I said, is a pest of even flowers. What happens if they feed on the flowers before it develops, the flower doesn't develop. It causes an abortion of the flower. And so stink bugs, as I said, it's hard to be overly kind to them.
And on that note, Phil, we'll say goodbye. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Phil. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be back, and we'll talk with him again. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of the way it works. We talk with a nutrition education expert tomorrow about how we can enjoy the holidays without ignoring our health. And then Mike Bino, editor of Our Wisconsin magazine, will give us the insider scoop on his latest edition. In the meantime, I hope you'll stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.